Naturalism is a worldview of which atheism is a subset. And naturalism says the natural world is all there is. And generally says, although this is changing, naturally, it generally says what we know we observe through data and through reason. It's more connected to the modern worldview, although there's postmodern varieties of it. But what they all have in common is this: there's no supernatural. All right. So what good does near-death experiences help on this naturalism, supernaturalism continuum? Basically, I'm going to argue that near-death experiences, to the extent that they can't be ruled out naturally, we'll talk about that. Near-death experiences talk about a spiritual dimension to life and a reality which can be checked and evidenced. But I do not think near-death experiences help us to choose which worldview is correct. I will not argue that worldview that near-death experiences prove Christianity. I won't argue that. I think worldviews are non-worldview specific. By that I mean they can be employed and incorporated into almost anybody's worldview. So why do this? Well, like I said, for one reason, because on state campus it's a con for seekers. It's for people who are interested in saying, is there more to life than what we see? But the second reason to do this is because what near-death experiences have in common is they argue that the natural world is not all there is. Hence, the reigning worldview is incorrect. Naturalism is wrong in that it does not explain much of, and maybe even the most important portion of, reality. So that's the main philosophical value, not to say people say they went to heaven, therefore there must be, Christianity must be true. It doesn't work like that. So I'll tell you where the hang-ups are. But basically it says that the major worldview is in trouble because it doesn't incorporate data about the realities. But maybe put what I'm saying together with Dr. Dembski's lecture, maybe. And he said, you know, Darwinism reigned for a while, not because it explained, as one philosopher says, Darwin doesn't explain the arrival of the fittest, it explains the survival of the fittest. Not the arrival. Darwin's not so good on the arrival. Inter-intelligent design to talk about the arrival. And to talk about how, as Dr. Dembski said, how biology has shown that even they don't do so well with the survival either. It's sort of like that. That it's one of more of those areas. Think of maybe near death is about along the line about as far as intelligent design is. What's the major critique of intelligent design? You guys don't go far enough. Some intelligent design guys think they do go far enough. Most Christians say, no, you gotta take it all the way to Genesis. I will just admit up front, mine doesn't go that far. Mine doesn't go to Christianity. Mine says naturalism is wrong. The natural world is not all there is. Okay, having said that, what is death? In order to talk about a near-death experience, we have to talk about death. Death comes in different definitions. Let me give you a series of ascending definitions. We'll get more and more complicated as we go up. But one thing's for sure, death is not like the old black and white westerns where they're trying to get some guy to talk before he kicks the bucket, right? And he goes, the gold is hidden in the... You don't die like that. Death takes place over minutes, and you lose sense experience progressively. And certain of your senses go before others. And there's disagreements about what goes and what goes first, and how long can you be out and be revived without brain damage or severe brain damage, and so on. But let's start with four definitions. Lowest on the list is near-death. What's a near-death experience? A near-death experience is a medical crisis from which you can reasonably be expected to die without medical intervention. We see this state all the time, especially the better we get with medicine and instruments and so on. Okay? A medical state from which you can reasonably be expected to die if you don't get some help. You know, you hear this on ER, and I never watch these things, but you know, what scream? He doesn't have a heartbeat. There's no pulse. Or I can't find it, or it's almost gone, or think, oh, this guy's in trouble. Okay. Next definition. No heart no hard activity. It's more technical. Because oftentimes NDEs, or not in the, not the E part, but the near-death state, is often determined by somebody at the site just checking your pulse or feeling your neck or something like that. But there's different ways to tell when the heart's not working, but especially when hooked up to an EKG. Estimates are that your heart cannot stop beating maybe for as few as 2 to 3 minutes. Probably by the time we get to the 5 minute point, it's real significant. And most doctors think there's no way there's irretrievable brain loss after 7 minutes. Most people talk about 5 minutes. And by the time you get close to 5 minutes, you're in a lot of danger. And even if you were revived, you know, you might have a Terry Schiavo case or something. You might have a case where you got them, but they've lost a lot of their brain capacity to be able to think and so on. Okay, next definition is brain stoppage. It's rare to get this because people don't need to measure brain activity to get a certificate of death. In fact, we often use the lowest definition for a certificate of death, and somebody who's qualified to say so says there's no heartbeat, there's no, and we rarely hook people up to machines, unless you're already hooked up to machines. But the third one is no brain waves. Now, the tricky one with this is, more people come back after heart stoppage than come back after brain stoppage. But people do come back after brain stoppage. But the point is, if your brain was stopped, the recorder's not working, if you don't mind that physical explanation. I mean, I do think you're learning things, but you're talking about another part of your body. I mean, you're talking about your spirit or something. But a person with a damaged brain can be doing well in their spirit, I think. It's like a guy trapped in a cabin with all the windows blocked. You could be doing fine inside the cabin, but you can't see out. You know, it's one of the mechanisms is damaged. And the thing with brainwave activity is if the brain stops functioning for any amount of time, even if that person comes back, they can't report what's going on when their brain's not working. In other words, to use my analogy, you can't tell what's going on a mile away when you're inside your cabin and all the outside crevices and windows are blocked. The highest, the most difficult definition of biological death, which naturalists like, is biological death. It's real simple. You're dead if you never come back. If you're revived, you weren't. So that's the hardest definition. Hardline definition is death is death when it's irreversible. Before that, it's near death. Now I would propose that we have near death data from after each of those categories. All right, here's somebody who's near death. Are there any near death cases where fractions of say minutes after that, they are cognizant of what's going around them? Where everybody's screaming because they're dead? Easily. Hundreds of cases. All right, how about no heartbeat? Is there anything after the 2 minute mark where they're aware of their surroundings? Funny. After the 5 minute mark? Yeah. 7 minute mark? You betcha. Wait a minute. Science says that's impossible. Hence the problem with the natural worldview. How about brainwave? How about flat brainwave readings? It's rare. But do we have people report data during demonstrably flat brain periods? Yes, we do. They should be able to do that. Now, the smart aleck on the fourth definition says, did you come back? Did you come back? Then you weren't. All right, well, we've got something we'll show you about their level, too. Because there's even data beyond that level. So how can there be? You're not coming back. We'll see. Okay, let me give you some examples from each. Like I said, he's not particularly Christian, but I've gone out of my way over the years to interview mostly children and Christian adults who, to the best of their ability, have never monkeyed with the occult. I think that's probably, from a biblical viewpoint, going to give us our most untainted data. Although I'm going to say, just because a person hasn't messed with the occult doesn't mean that they're not good, doesn't mean that everything they see, they're good reporters. Christians can be lousy reporters too. No, it was a red car, they hit the blue car. There's no red car out there. Well, I'm telling you, it was a red car. You know, Christians can be just as pig-headed and just as wrong about facts as non-Christians can. So it doesn't mean they can report things well. It just means maybe we can kind of corral that occultic portion just a little bit. All right. What I'm going to do is tell you a series of stories. And if you've not heard these kind of things before, there are a lot of them. And they're in print. This may surprise you. A number of these are in print in medical journals. They've been written up in major medical journals. And I'm going to pick stories after each one. Okay? What about a post-near-death experience? What about a post-heart stoppage? What about a post-brain stoppage? And so on. And some of these are incredible. Very incredible. Hard to know it. Hard to know what to do with. And I'll try to leave some room for Q&A, but by the time we get to the end, if I can fit it in sideways, I'd like to tell you a story of one of the best-known philosophical atheists in the world who's proclaimed to his dying day that there's no afterlife and nothing beyond this world. And then, boom, he had two near-death experiences. I say, couldn't happen to a better guy. Because he thinks he came face-to-face with God, only he's an atheist. And he won't call him God.
Did it change him?
No. Well, it's a super good question. Did it change him publicly? No. But something was going on privately, and to this day, people wonder if he went through some conversion experience. It's really, really interesting. I'll try to squeeze that story in. And by the way, when it happened, the guy was just nasty. And he said, I didn't meet God. It wasn't God I saw. But listen to his description. He stood behind the being who's responsible for the creation of the universe. But that's not God. I mean, anything but denied. Okay. Well, let me use one and work our way up. Here's a simple one. And this story has been told maybe more than almost any other story. A young woman, Marie, was visiting friends in Seattle, Washington. She'd never been to Seattle before. This has been written up in medical literature. Marie had never been to Seattle, and shortly after arriving, she had a pretty bad heart attack. They called the 911 folks. Paramedics came and took her. And in Seattle is a hospital in Harborview Hospital, which is often said to be the most advanced heart treatment center in the world. Well, she was taken to Harborview. And as she was being revived, she came to, and she said, hey, I want you all to bring me in here. I said, you what? You were out. Yeah, I know, but here's what happened. Okay, well, tell us. Well, when those guys got me off the stretcher, they wheeled me into the room. Here's what the inside of the room looked like. But she was out. She was out cold. So she started to get attention from people by saying, I could see my surroundings. So, by the way, that's the kind of story I look for. I have collected over 100 stories of near-death experiences with corroborating evidence. And so she said, yeah, she described the room, she described the guys who did this. She could say, well, you know, maybe she's not totally out. Maybe she could tell what they did to her. Okay, but when she's out, how about what happened behind her in the room? And so on. Well, anyway, finally she got people's attention when she said, I started drifting. I watched for a while, but then I started drifting up through the ceilings. And I went through a couple floors. And by the way, the longer the experience lasts, and the deeper the experience lasts, the more spiritual dimensions are recognized. So if it's just for a few minutes, the person might stay right in the room, and then they zip back in their body, and all of a sudden they feel this pain in their chest, or something like that. But the longer it lasts, they start drifting elsewhere. And she said, I left the hospital, and I was going up, and you know something real funny about your guys' hospital? On the wing over there, on the top of the floor, there's a blue tennis shoe on the roof. He said, I just happened to notice it. And when I looked at it, it's like I had telephoto vision and I zoomed in on it. And she said, it's a large, blue canvas, men's tennis shoe, very large. And she said, the laces were tied underneath it, and the little toe, where the little toe would go, the little toe was worn almost through. Well, now there's some, not only is this very, very specific, these are some odd things. A tennis shoe is very, very large. and the laces are tied underneath it, that's on top of the roof. Well, a social worker who could speak Spanish and was asked to come in and talk to Marie heard the story, and she took her brakes and went over in that part of the hospital, and she went to the rooms and she looked out the windows, and don't tell us you, your mom, that's what you get. And she kept, and she'd do a little more. There's only one part of the hospital she had to check, and she told me, I mean, I've interviewed a number of these people, doctors and others, but she said, people make me sound like some Spider-Man. She said, I didn't crawl out on the roof or anything, but she said, I opened up the window and I looked out around the side. She said, no way you could see this, even from the window. Plus, Marie was on the bottom floor, first time she'd been to Seattle. And she said, around the corner is this big tennis shoe. She said, I reached, and I kind of got up a little bit. I didn't want to get out there, so I kind of got up on the ledge and I reached and I got it. And I said, what happened to this tennis shoe? Well, she told me the story. She went downstairs and she put it behind her back and she walked into Marie's room. And she said, tell me one more time the story of the tennis shoe. And she told her, she goes, is this it? It was a size 15. It was a men's blue canvas tennis shoe. The little toe was through. Now, this part of the story wasn't exactly correct. The laces were not tied underneath, but the shoe was sitting on the laces. So it looked like that if you're looking at it. And so I asked the social worker, she and I have talked probably a couple hours. I said, whatever happened to that shoe? Oh, I brought her home and put it in the garage. She said, my husband and I cleaned out the garage a little while ago. I don't think we have it anymore. I thought, wow. You know, I thought, that's a keepsake. What'd you guys take it out of the trash or what? But this has been written up. And now, how would you explain? You can maybe think of some other methods. But you're going to have to come up with something here if you're a naturalist. You're going to have to come up with something that explains every one of my examples. And I have... You can say, don't use that one, use another one. You can take these things out and put them in just as easily. There's many, many evidential cases. So let me go to the heart one. I know a case of a person, this is reported by a cardiologist, a man who reported the corroborative near-death data, and his heart did not beat for 44 minutes. Way, way, way beyond the, is it 2, is it 5, is it 7? And almost, by the way, very few people think you can remember anything after 7. Most people think you can't get anything. His was, I want to say 44 minutes. I have to go back and check my notes. Say 44 minutes. And he reported data during that time. Flat brainwave. Well, I know a cardiologist. I've spoken to this guy. He may be retired now, but probably 15 years ago I spoke to him. He's well enough known. He's a Denver cardiologist. He's well enough known that he's a pacemaker named after him. And he has had more near-death patients than probably anybody else on record. I don't know if that means don't go to him or what. But he's had 2,400 near-death patients. And 1,600 of them reported near-death data. Now,
what do you mean by reported near-death data?
You were out for 5 minutes. I was. I could tell everything that was happy. Well, I was kind of watching from above my body.
Have a narrative.
Yeah.
To share afterwards.
Now, you say, and I don't put a lot of credence in near-death data. I should have told you this right up front. According to Gallup, 8 million Americans have had near-death phenomena, seen it, witnessed it, watched another's death, seen it themselves, and got revived. 8 million Americans. And people say, well, I was going down a tunnel, I saw a light. And let me tell you a few things about that. Number one, only small percentages of people see each of those. And people roll them all together and just, you know, you see the movie going down a tunnel. Or maybe you might get up there to 40% or 50%. There might be some pretty good sized figures. But I don't care. I don't care how many people, I don't care if 90% of everybody sees a light in the tunnel. That's not helpful to me because it could be, as a naturalist say, that could be the result of a dying brain. It could be brain chemistry. We all have common brains. We all have brain chemistry in common. How do I know that my brain couldn't produce that? Now, I'm only interested in collaborative cases. I want to tell you that. Okay, flat brainwaves. This cardiologist, of his 2,400 cases, 1,600 near death, and the point I was making was just because he had 1,600 death, that's a lot. It's interesting to say that what percentage of people in his case, by the way, if you're interested in that question, anywhere between one-third and two-thirds of people who are near death report near death phenomena. One-third to two-thirds. Those are just data. They're just interesting. I'm interested in the evidential cases. This guy had 57 cases of people reporting phenomena without brainwave activity. For how long? Well, some of his people did not have brainwave activity for anywhere between 30 minutes and 3 hours. No brainwave activity. And they reported data that could be confirmed. Now, the only kind of data that can be confirmed is data in the, not totally, but 95% of confirmable data is in this world, right? It's the next room. It's out in the street out there. It's there's no windows in this room. I saw a car accident out there. Red car hit a green car, and I couldn't see it if I was totally cognizant and sitting in my hospital bed. But I saw it in great detail. And you go, wait a minute. We know when you were out. You were out between 3:01 and 4:20. We've got good data on that. When did the car accident happen? 3:30. When did they get it cleared away? 3:55. It's right during the time when you have no brainwave activity. So you can do that kind of coordination. Some of this gets very sophisticated. And now you know why some of this stuff gets written up in journals. You just don't know where to look for it. All right. He has 57 cases of heart stoppage with cooperation. Let me tell you a couple specific cases. I'll tell you two specific cases. A woman in Indiana was dying. They had her hooked up to an EEG. And she died. They worked on it for about 45 minutes, pronounced her dead, pulled the sheet overhead, called the morgue attendants in, and the guys were pushing her body down the hospital hallways to the hospital morgue. And while they were pushing her down the hallway, she sat up on the gurney. sort of Twilight Zone. She sat up. They ran and got a doctor, gave her a shot of adrenaline. She died later. I mean, she was in a bad state, but they did. She was alive for a while. She reported, while she had no brainwave activities, she reported what kind of clothes the nurses were wearing, who ran in, who was not roped up exactly because it was an emergency and they came in trying to help her. She reported a couple specific kinds of jewelry. She reported who cracked a joke in the room to relieve tension. And she had no brainwaves the whole time. This is one of my favorite cases. A little girl named Crystal drowned in a pool in the Northwest, and she was underwater for 19 minutes. This is known information. She's underwater in her pool, and she might have been the girl. You parents, watch out. She may have been the girl. There was definitely one like this. She may have been the girl who got her hair caught in the drain in the pool, and that's why she got pulled down. They couldn't get her out. When they got her to the emergency room, she was comatose. In fact, the doctor's report is profoundly comatose, no brainwave readings. The doctor said she has a 1 in 10 chance of surviving, a 1 in 10,000 chance of surviving with brain function. I talked to the attending doctor, who, interestingly enough, as chance would have it, the attending doctor was a pediatric brain specialist. He was the one who was on duty when she came in. And he said, no brainwave activity, and she's out. They hooked her up as best they could, put her on machines, probably not unlike the Terry Schiavo thing, as far as what they hooked her up with. Took her into intensive care. Her parents went home for the night. 3 days later, she spontaneously revived, no new medicine, no new set of circumstances. She revived. The doctor came in. She said, looked up and she said, thanks for saving me. She said, pardon me? Thanks for saving me. Where's your other buddy? The tall guy with the beard. He said, I'll go get him for you. He went down the hall. He got his buddy. They came back and they sat by her bed and took notes for 1 hour. She said, you know what? I wasn't out all that time. I don't know what y'all thought, but Elizabeth took me around. Who's Elizabeth? Elizabeth's an angel. Well, there's no test for angels. But she said Elizabeth allowed her, kind of took care of her and comforted her, and allowed her to look in on her parents. Parents have gone home for the night. So the medical doctors, they can't do much about Elizabeth, but when she says she looked in on her parents, they could take notes, right? Well, what were they doing? What was your dad doing? He was sitting in the living room, he was reading the paper, he was kind of preoccupied, he got frustrated, he put the paper down, he just was really you know, look bothered. What'd your little son, what'd your little brother do? He went upstairs in his room, she named the toy he was playing with. What'd your daughter do? Went upstairs in her room, named the toy she was playing with, named a popular song that was on the radio that the kids were humming. She said, my mom was in the kitchen. What's your mom doing? Dinner. Well, it was 2 nights ago. What'd your mom make for dinner? Roast chicken and rice. Roast chicken and rice. Well, they told the parents, your daughters come too. They came rushing to the hospital, and the doctor said, sir, where were you sitting the other night? Do you know, where was your son? What was your daughter doing? Ma'am, what'd you make for dinner 2 nights ago? Chicken and rice. It's still in the fridge. Thanks. She has no brainwave activity. She's locked down, but Elizabeth, interesting, again, no test for Elizabeth, but she can report. By the way, people are generally taken to where their loved ones are. They're drawn to them. Maybe I should say taken. Drawn to where their loved ones are. And some of them, I think of one of these cases, there's such a thing as near-death humor.